This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
Join Aaron and Bill for We the People Radio, Sundays, noon until 2.
It's conservative talk radio with a liberal dose of humor. Get the whole story from experts around the world delivering facts rather than opinion.
Missed a show? Busy at noon? No problem. Listen to our free archives when you have time. No commercial interruptions or download restrictions. We the People Radio.
.us.
Do you have something you'd like to get painted? Then bring it to Victory Powder Coating. Powder coating is a durable, colorful, environmentally friendly alternative to paint. It's useful in automotive, agricultural, decorative, and high-temperature applications. Victory Powder Coating has become the North State leader in powder coating applications and metal finishing. They specialize in large industrial items like truck beds, agricultural equipment, and trailers. They're dedicated to providing superior work and outstanding customer care. Consider Victory Powder Coating for your next project. Victory Powder Coating.
Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. Arturo Fuente Chateau Maduro, handmade in the Dominican Republic with a dark Connecticut broadleaf wrapper, giving us a rich, medium-bodied cigar with pleasant notes of coffee, vanilla, and sweet spiciness. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Redding Rodeo returns May 14th through the 17th. Four nights of rodeo excitement and fun for the whole family. We even added breakaway roping. Get your tickets now at reddingrodeo.com. Bulls, barrels, broncs, and big-time thrills. Thank you to our sponsors, Sierra Pacific Industries, Block Beverage, Pendleton Whiskey, SNL Good, Redding Rancheria, Redding Rodeo, May 14th through the 17th. Get your tickets now at reddingrodeo.com.
Invest in your future today with a degree or certificate from Shasta College. Get job ready fast with one of our high-demand career technical programs like nursing, heavy equipment, and welding. Or work on transferring to a CSU or UC with guaranteed placement. Full-time students get 2 years tuition-free. Summer session begins June 9th. Click or call 242-7650. Your success starts at Shasta College.
We're back 6 days a week. Since 1938, Jack's Grill is served fabulous steaks. Pork tender filet mignon, New York steak or brochet of beef, all cooked to perfection and so tender you can cut it with a smile. Deep fried prawns and southern fried chicken. All dinners served with garlic bread, hot baked potato or french fries, and a large family style bowl of tossed green salad with a homemade dressing of your choice. Whatever you're in the mood for, meet friends and family at Jack's Grill. Open Monday through Saturday now with comfortable patio seating. A Redding landmark at their historical location on California Street, downtown Redding.
It's rodeo week, and once again, those crazy yellow-shirted asphalt cowboys are on the loose. As usual, they bumbled the annual bank robbery. You can win cash by unmasking the lone stranger and finding the hidden loot. Corral one of those slippery cowboys for tickets to this Friday morning's world-famous pancake breakfast downtown in the Whistle Stop Park. Tickets are only $6 in advance, $7 Friday morning, and downtown street parking is free for the breakfast. Saddle up, it's Asphalt Cowboys Rodeo Week.
Owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
So presented himself so well that he became the hit of Paris. Everybody in Paris would visit him in his prison cell before he was guillotined. And this inspired Dostoevsky, the great Russian Christian novelist, to write his book, ultimately, Crime and Punishment, one of the greatest novels about murder in history. And that actually encapsulated the theories of Nietzsche before Nietzsche actually started writing. And Nietzsche then started writing and saying that God was dead and therefore strong men had to invent a new morality. And this in turn inspired two killers in America in 1920, in the 1920s, called Leopold and Loeb. And that was one of the, what was called the crime of the century. It was one of the biggest murders in history. It got more press than anything else. And Leopold and Loeb then went on to inspire, I don't know, it's got to be over a dozen films, TV shows, novels. But this became a famous play named Rope. Alfred Hitchcock made that into a movie. And it's just been done again and again, the idea of two people killing because they think they're superior to other people. So that's one of the murders. It's actually one and a half murder. The other is, the second one is Ed Gein. Mm-hmm. And Ed Gein was a famous murderer of 1950s America in Wisconsin, rural Wisconsin, who killed women and also dug up their bodies and then dressed in their flesh because he wanted to be a woman. He thought that would change his body into being a female. This inspired first the novel and then the movie Psycho, which is considered one of the greatest American movies of all time. And it also inspired the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Mm-hmm. And ultimately the whole slasher genre was based on these murders by Ed Gein, and the themes of that murder kept coming up again and again. And finally, it inspired Silence of the Lambs, which is actually based on the Ed Gein murders as well. And finally, I deal with the last murder I deal with is the first murder, which is Cain's killing of Abel. And, you know, this, in fact, is the underpinning of many, many novels and movies. But because it's so many of them, I couldn't deal with that. So what I deal with is the themes of Cain and Abel as they recur throughout the Bible, even up into and including the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And in each of these stories, what I'm trying to get at is the way that artists take darkness and evil and turn it into beauty, and through beauty, revelation, and a not just a connection to God, but a way of sort of maintaining joy, which is one of the things we are told to do in the Bible, to rejoice, even as we're surrounded by darkness and evil in this broken world. And that's kind of the theme of the book.
Andrew Klavan with us, his book, The Kingdom of Cain, Finding God in the Literature of Darkness. I had a number of thoughts as I read through that section of the book. Let's see what we can talk about. These silly, stupid, in a way, slasher films that you reference, Halloween, which is actually a good one from John Carpenter, yes. Texas Chainsaw Massacre. There is just the awfulness of death, of course, but played for laughs in these movies, in places. And in many of these, there is this latent morality going on, whether it be in Halloween, as you mentioned, the family structure that sort of leads to problems, or in something as simplistic as Friday the 13th, where the kids who are smoking, the kids who are having sex, they're the ones who die first. Those wholesome rule followers end up surviving in the end. What does that tell us about how we deal with tragedy?
Well, it's really fascinating. As Nietzsche predicted, God had sort of gone out of the Western world. And to replace him, people started to theorize, intellectuals started to theorize that the source of God was within us. In other words, God was not something outside ourselves. We must have essentially made him up. So Freud would say that, you know, he was our fathers that we projected onto the heavens and all this. And as that happens, then you start to sort of seize control of your own being. You're not a created being anymore. You are a self-created. And part of that self-creation is choosing what sex you are, as we see people do today. If all we are is meat, then all you have to do is change the shape of that meat, and you've essentially changed your inner nature. And that is what Ed Gein was trying to do, and that was what was so inspiring to Alfred Hitchcock and Thomas Harris, who wrote Silence of the Lambs, and to all of these murders. And so what you see in these slasher films is you see two things at once. You see people losing the essentials of human life, gender, family, motherhood. One of the things about Halloween, if you watch it closely, it's really about a suburb where the mothers have disappeared from the kitchen windows. And the other thing you see developing at the same time in these movies as they go along is the role of the psychiatrist. So the psychiatrist is a guy who now has replaced the priest. He's going to define everything for you. If you look at Psycho ends with a psychiatrist coming on and explaining everything. And the people who made the movie actually called it the head shrinker explains it all scene. And he comes in, he's authoritative, he says, this is what happened, this is why this guy was a killer, this is why he changed sexes, and there it is. Then you get to Halloween, And the psychiatrist turns up, and this guy is killing people, and the psychiatrist has been treating him, and he says, I don't know, I can't do anything about this guy. He's evil. He's just evil, you know? He actually reverts to the old idea that there's something inside us that's spiritual, and he can't touch it. He can't reach it. And by the time you get to Silence of the Lambs, the psychiatrist is the source of the evil. So it's as if the arts are telling us that when we lost our faith, when we started to decide that we could find God within ourselves, when we started to decide that we could define the moral world mm-hmm. and the physical world from within ourselves, we actually were on a path to evil. We thought the psychiatrist was healing us. We thought he was the expert. But in fact, he was Hannibal Lecter. He turned us into meat. And that's what Hannibal Lecter does. He eats the people that he kills. He just turns them into the most material thing they can be. And so if you trace that murder through the art, through the arts, you actually learn a lot about Ed Gein, not just about Ed Gein, but about the current transgender movement, what it's trying to do, and why it's so violent mm-hmm. when it's opposed.
We will return in just a moment to talk more with Andrew Klavan about his new book, The Kingdom of Cain. I have a question about The Silence of the Lambs to ask. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, I'm Reagan, a student at Hillsdale College. Here's an excerpt from George Washington's farewell address in 1796.
It is substantially true that virtue or morality is a necessary spring of popular government. The rule, indeed, extends with more or less force to every species of free government. Who that is a sincere friend to it can look with indifference upon attempts to shake the foundation of the fabric. Promote, then, as an object of primary importance, institutions for the general diffusion of knowledge. In proportion as the structure of a government gives force to public opinion, it is essential that public opinion should be enlightened.
That was an excerpt from George Washington's farewell address brought to you by Hillsdale College. To learn more about Hillsdale, visit hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
Hi, I'm Steven, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on the enduring importance of federalism.
Many in Washington today have grown so accustomed to centralized bureaucracy that they think of federalism as old-fashioned, kind of like fife and drum music. Those who wrote the Constitution saw federalism as a vital principle of free government in a large republic. The division of power between the federal government, state governments, and local governments would serve as an important protection against tyranny. The founders also understood that while the federal government is essential for national matters like foreign policy and defense, governments closer to the people were far better suited to oversee local matters. As we see in the problems that result from centralized bureaucracy today, there's nothing out of date about the founders' argument for federalism.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
You're listening to What's in a Name. Though this particular Michigan city's name at first look has a fairly simple origin story, it's a bit more complicated than it first seems. The name Detroit comes from a French word that means straight, like a body of water, which in turn comes from the city's positioning around the Detroit River. The river comes from Lake Erie, one of the five Great Lakes. The city still remains as one of the oldest and most important cities in the Midwest. So the name comes from French settlements in the early 18th century, which was roughly 300 years ago. The land itself has been populated for over 11,000 years by many different peoples, including the Iroquois and the Hurons. Rich in resources, it was highly contested, and after many battles, ultimately ended up within the United States, first as a territory and then as part of the state of Michigan. It has since earned the nickname of the Motor City due to its history with Henry Ford. This has been What's in a Name. My name is Megan Pidcock, and you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Hey, it's Scott Bertram, and I want to tell you about something new from Hillsdale College. It's the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. Check it out right now. Go to podcast.hillsdale.edu. The Hillsdale College Podcast Network offers free nationwide access to all of Hillsdale's podcast content. That means shows like the Hillsdale Dialogues, the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, the Hillsdale College K-12 Classical Education Podcast, the Larry P. Arn Show. You can listen wherever you are and whenever you want. And it's always free. Find out more about all of our shows at podcast.hillsdale.edu. You can subscribe to any program with new episodes delivered right to your device. If you want to come close to stepping inside a Hillsdale College classroom, well, the Hillsdale College Podcast Network is for you. Get informed and get entertained at podcast.hillsdale.edu. That's podcast.hillsdale.edu. We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. We've been talking with the great Andrew Clavin. His brand new book, The Kingdom of Cain, Finding God in the Literature of Darkness. Andrew,
I'm the Ed Gein murders, and more specifically the Silence of the Lambs film. I think you get this a little bit in The Kingdom of Cain. We have Lecter, we have Buffalo Bill, two killers without a conscience. Are we, as we watch Silence of the Lambs, which, by the way, is just an incredible piece of art,
yep,
are we supposed to believe that one of those two men is more evil than the other?
I think that certainly in the book, and I think in the movie too, I actually like the book better than the movie, but I think that in both of them, Hannibal Lecter is in charge.
Mm-hmm.
He is the man who pulls the strings. He understands not just himself, but others. And he uses his powers as a psychiatrist to manipulate them. Buffalo Bill, who is the Ed Gein character in this, is kind of an idiot. He's kind of carried away. But the thing that he has learned from Hannibal Lecter and from the world, the culture that he lives in, is that people are just meat. And if he can change the shape of his body, he will change his gender. And that's why he kills the women, in order to make an outfit, a female outfit out of them. And in the book, I think it's in the movie too, he's hunted down by this very beautiful detective. And when they confront each other, Buffalo Bill's last words to her is, "How does it feel to be so beautiful?" He envies her. So he's a guy who's kind of carried away by his emotions, by his madness, by his lust and his desire to be something that he's not. But Hannibal Lecter is in charge. You know, he outsmarts everybody. And he is almost the character that we almost identify with in the story. So it's a close run thing, but I think we have to declare him more evil because he has more control over himself.
Andrew Clavin with us, the book, The Kingdom of Cain, Finding God in the Literature of Darkness. True crime is so popular in today's society, culture, particularly in the podcast realm and on cable TV. And my wife loves it. She watches. And Andrew, I must tell you, when she does, if I have any minute portion of interest in what's happening on the screen, you know what I do? I Google the guy's name, and I find out in 4 seconds the way this thing ends. And I don't have to sit there for 2 hours to find out what happens. But people don't.
Spoil sport.
Yeah, but people don't do that. Does it say something about us that we feel compelled not just to know, but to watch it unfold in some way?
Well, yes, I think, yes, stories are very powerful things because the truth, the actual reality is kind of amorphous. It's kind of one big thing. You know, everything is actually one big thing. And what stories do is they break down our psychology and reality into characters who move around and act out certain truths about the world. And, you know, that's how therapy works. You find out different parts of yourself and you put them off against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so following that story is an experience that leads you to resolution. If it's done well, it takes you to a new place. People think that, especially, I'm afraid to say that many Christians and conservatives think that a story is supposed to be a kind of sugar pill around a little object lesson. You know, the story makes it fun, but really we're teaching you a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how stories work at all. You know, some of them have little lessons in them, but the really great stories are just an experience. They are something that you go through, just like you might go through climbing a mountain, or you might go through suffering, or you might go through grief, or you might go through joy. A story is something you go through, and when you come out the other end, you are a little changed because something has been added to your soul that wasn't there before. And so I think that working your way through a murder story is a way of working through something in yourself that you recognize as evil, but that you don't want to actually possess, right? So you do it in this, you know, stories are safe. Nobody's really dying. Nobody's really getting killed. And a lot of people, strangely enough, I think, a lot of people feel guilty for enjoying a story about murder. There are stories about murder that are evil in themselves because they kind of romanticize it and encourage it and make it thrilling, sexually thrilling. But I think that a really great story about murder is as revelatory as anything else, if not more, because it takes you into evil and it shows you something about yourself and your, and ultimately, I believe it shows you something about your relationship to God. And I think that that's kind of what the book, my book is trying to get at, is what do these murders tell us about our relationship to God and what happens when we lose him and how maybe we can find him again.
Andrew Clayton with us, the book, The Kingdom of Cain, Finding God in the Literature of Darkness. As I read the chapter, the section on Cain and Abel, I could not help but think about music. I'm a huge music fan. And if we look back through the history of rock and roll, Andrew Clavin, we see brothers fighting and creating great art. The Kinks, CCR, the Black Crowes and Oasis of more recent vintage, even the Bee Gees, the Beach Boys to an extent. Is there something we know about siblings? Is there something we know about brothers that explains both why they can come together to create such timeless works of beauty, but also create such volatile relationships within this structure?
Yeah, I think, well, absolutely. I mean, almost in every myth, when they talk about the hero's journey, it frequently begins with some kind of challenge at the beginning of the journey. And one of those challenges is what's called the brother battle, where two brothers have to fight it out before they can move on either alone, one of them alone or together. And obviously Cain and Abel are the ultimate brother battle. And not only are they the ultimate brother battle, they're actually the pattern of history as it unfolds in the Old Testament. All the Jewish patriarchs are brothers. The younger one usually overcomes the older one. And so it's kind of the Cain and Abel story writ backwards. And it happens again and again. And in the end of the Bible, you find Jesus Christ appearing as the second Adam. So many people have thought that too is a brother battle, where the first Adam fails, the older brother again fails, and the younger brother then succeeds in finding his way back to the paradise the older brother lost. I think, look, a brother relationship, and I have three brothers, a brother relationship is like nothing else on earth. There is no one, until you find your wife or your spouse, there is no one with whom you have as physical a relationship. You fight, you touch each other, you know, you wrestle around in ways that you just simply do not do with your friends later on and with other people in your life. You know, there's an absolute physical connection, a shared household, a shared parentage, and ultimately there's a sort of otherness to your brother that is also yourself. And that is kind of the ultimate story of any hero has to go and confront the other who is himself but not himself. And I think the brothers kind of represent that. And I think in the Cain and Abel story, it's very easy to read the Cain and Abel story as two parts of a single person, one killing the other. And what I do with the Cain and Abel story and the other murders, I go through all the works of art that have been inspired by them, or many of the works of art that have been inspired by them. With Cain and Abel, I just go through the Bible and talk about the different themes that brother battles represent, including the theme of being separated from God or rejecting God, whereas somebody else accepts God, the envy that you feel when somebody else has a relationship with God and you do not.
The book is The Kingdom of Cain, Finding God in the Literature of Darkness. Andrew Clavin, the author, you read him for many years and listened to over at DailyWire.com to The Andrew Clavin Show, a fascinating and entertaining new book, The Kingdom of Cain. Andrew Clavin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Scott. It's been a pleasure.
Up next, Dr. Colin Brown joins us. We'll discuss his dissertation research into Benjamin Franklin, Revolutionary Statesman. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're listening to KCNR 96.5 FM at 1460 AM, your talk radio. Online at KCNR1460.com.
As we all get older, the one constant thing is the aggressive, excessive mail and advertising for Medicare, Medicare supplements, and Medicare Advantage. And almost every one of them is a call center with no idea of what you really need. Siskiyou Insurance has an agent that deals with nothing but Medicare issues and can explain the differences clearly between a Medicare supplement and Medicare Advantage. Call Greg Green at Siskiyou Insurance at 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345.
Hey, Redding, say big on Black Bear Diner's new basket bundles. Get your paws on a choice of sandwich, side, and drink for only $11. A great meal at a great price. Basket bundles, now available at Black Bear Diner. Be sure to stop by for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Black Bear Diner just added 4 brand new and 4 returning classics to the menu. Black Bear Diner, 2205 Hilltop Drive. Get big value and so many choices at Black Bear Diner.
Black Bear Diner.
At Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel is a full-service organization with department staff with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is financial advisor Susan Eastman at 530-244-7199. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Again, that number, 530-244-7199.
John Cruz here with America Outdoors Radio. Be sure to tune in this weekend and catch the latest in fishing, hunting, conservation, and destinations. If you love spending time in the field or on the water or in the woods, you're going to love this show. It's America Outdoors Radio, the fastest growing outdoors radio show in the nation. Tune in Saturdays from noon to 1 p.m. on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM KCNR, your talk radio.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenny, owner of Shasta Gas Propane and a Vietnam veteran. With Memorial Day coming up this 26th of May, I would like to remind you that it is more than a three-day weekend. With the words from President Ronald Reagan in one of his many Memorial Day speeches, he had just received the bodies of 4 Marines who had died while on active duty. He said, "There is a special sadness that accompanies the death of service members, because our country is never quite good enough to them. Not really. We can't be. Because what they gave us is beyond our power to repay. And all we can do is remember. Most of them were boys and girls when they died, and they gave up 2 lives. The one they were living and the one they would have. They gave up everything for us, and all we can do is remember and honor them. This Memorial Day, please remember and honor our fallen service men and women."
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
On behalf of the Chicks and Chaps 2025 Committee, we'd like to thank our following sponsors in helping to make this year's Chicks and Chaps Breast Cancer Awareness Luncheon the best ever. A heartfelt thanks goes to Fowler Oncology, Redding Rancheria, Goldmark, Shasta Regional Medical Center, Mercy Foundation, Lulu's, Holiday Harbor, Four Winds Jewelry, Urban Retreat, the Sheraton Hotel and Mosaic Restaurant, Ortega's Restaurant in Palisadro, Woody's Bar and Grill, and Wonderland Sign.
Experience Glowing Wild, an illuminated wildlife lantern festival at the Sundial Bridge and Turtle Bay Exploration Park in Redding, California. Open select nights April 4th through June 8th, 7 to 10 p.m. Featuring 10 acres of illuminated gardens filled with Asian lanterns inspired by plants and animals from around the world. Plus food, drinks, live performances on select nights, and much more. Don't miss Turtle Bay's Glowing Wild Lantern Festival at the Sundial Bridge. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
North Valley Distributing at 3081 Crossroads Drive is a major supplier of electrical and electronic products for the industrial and construction markets. North Valley Distributing focuses on quality and reliability. Their products include fuses, batteries, wiring devices, connectors, lighting solutions, circuit protection components, and electrical tools and more. North Valley Distributing at 3081 Crossroads Drive, a proud sponsor of the Reading Colt 45s.
Ready to turn your dreams into reality? At Simpson University, we offer a private Christian education that enriches your academic journey with faith and purpose. Whether you're pursuing your undergraduate degree, completing your degree, or advancing through graduate studies, our dynamic programs, personalized mentorship, and vibrant community are here to support you. Discover how Simpson University can help you achieve your goals and grow spiritually. Visit simpsonu.edu today to learn more. Simpson University, where your potential is limitless.
Shasta Lake and neighboring friends, the Queen of Dragons has your back with premium products at prices that work for you. As the longest standing dispensary in the area, our local team knows exactly what you need. Our shelves are stocked with the freshest flower in town. From our premium, fresh, and local line to our budget-friendly options featuring Emerald Junkies and Tricana Boys. Don't miss our famous Flower Friday deals. Top quality at unbeatable prices. And for the green thumbs out there, clones are now in store for the growing season. Join our Dragons Reward program and earn points with every purchase. Stop by 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake or call us for delivery at 530-276-9771 or check out our menu at thequeenofdragons.com. The Queen of Dragons, premium offerings, unbeatable value just for you.
Although the dissertation does show that he does track towards a more revolutionary style of politics over the, as time goes on. But he wanted to go back to or essentially refound Pennsylvania and then the colonies as a whole, and maybe even the British Empire eventually, on first principles. So he wanted to bring back the governments that he lived in back to first principles, back to a form of government that he believed more consistent with human nature and human flourishing. And for him, that form of government was Republican. So political equality, he was a proponent of natural rights and sought to secure a form of government that was consistent with man's natural rights, as well as his in the British tradition, rights as Englishmen. And so a strong legislature that was made up of elected representatives was key for his view of government.
Who were the Whigs and what were their goals around this time?
So the Whigs were one of the two major factions within British politics. They're mostly the Whigs and the Tories, mostly associated with the Glorious Revolution at the end of the 17th century. The Whigs were considered victorious. There was a new settlement following the Glorious Revolution. Eventually they would become parliamentarians is probably the best way to describe them. By the time of the revolution, the more moderate Whigs believed in a kind of form of parliamentary supremacy, the king in parliament and the legislative as being the supreme power within the British Empire. Now there were within the Whigs, you could say there were kind of two versions or two kinds. There are the moderate Whigs and then the more radical Whigs who tended to follow the ideas of John Locke, Algernon Sidney, John Trenchard, and Thomas Gordon, who were the two writers behind Cato's Letters. This more Republican social compact version of Whig thought was what kind of constituted the more radical Whigs. Hmm. And most Americans in the colonies, they were either Tories or more radical Whigs. All of the revolutionaries tended to be more of this radical Whig sort.
Talking with Dr. Colin Brown about his research into Benjamin Franklin, his dissertation on Benjamin Franklin, Revolutionary Statesman. So what were Franklin's politics? What camp or what faction did he belong to?
That's a great question, and it's one that scholars debate all the time, whether you're a historian or a political theorist like myself or a literary historian. Franklin himself tried to stay above factional politics, right? He wanted to present himself as kind of an independent, probably is the best way to describe it. But and as a neutral observer. But he was also a very political man, even before he entered the Pennsylvania Assembly. So with his newspaper, the Pennsylvania Gazette, he often commented on and published pieces commenting on the political issues of the day. And these, his opinions and the kind of trajectory or general orientation of his newspaper tended to support what scholars call the Quaker Popular Party. These were the Pennsylvanians who believed in a strong legislature, a strong assembly. They wanted it to be a unicameral legislature. So rather than have the legislative power divided between an upper and lower house, the Popular Party in Pennsylvania thought that the elected representatives ought to have the majority, if not all, of the legislative power. And Franklin tended to side with them. He did have friends among the other faction, the proprietary faction, who sided with the proprietors of Pennsylvania, the Penn family, and their associates. And so Franklin navigated the two factions, but on a matter of principle, he ended up 99 out of 100 times siding with the Popular Party.
What did Franklin see as sort of the foundation of society?
There were really two foundations, I think. The first is human nature and man's sociable inclinations. So he believed that man was a social creature by nature. He, in a journal from, he's probably in his early to mid 20s at this point, he's on a ship and he comes to the conclusion that, you know, you could have all the knowledge and wisdom in the world, but if you didn't have anyone to share it with, your life was poor for it. So he thought man was inherently inclined to live with others like him, with fellow men. Now that not only served as the basis of society, but it also tended to be the basis of conflict. And a lot of the conflict arose from both man's kind of selfish or self-interested inclinations. So Franklin has an essay where he says man is both benevolent and selfish. He has parts of him that orient him towards society and then parts of him that orient him towards viewing his own interests. But the other foundation that kind of arose out of this was human opinion. And Franklin thought that human opinion tended to be the basis of all political dominion. Whether or not it was explicit, all government was based upon some kind of consent, usually tacit consent. But he was very concerned about governments ascertaining and maintaining the good opinion of the governed. And based upon this view, he came to the opinion that something like social compact theory, which makes consent explicit, was the best political program, for lack of a better word, by which to orient one's society. Because that way, opinions are acknowledged by the governors, and there are means by which opinion can consistently be acknowledged and change the government if necessary.
Talking with Dr. Colin Brown about his research into Benjamin Franklin, revolutionary statesman. More next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. Arturo Fuente, Chateau Maduro. Handmade in the Dominican Republic with a dark Connecticut broadleaf wrapper, giving us a rich, medium-bodied cigar with pleasant notes of coffee, vanilla, and sweet spiciness. Get yours today at Tobacco & Brew, Redding, California.
You have a choice when it comes to your cancer care, and I want you to know that at Valor Oncology, we are here to provide the best possible care right here in Reading. I'm Dr. Lauren Strickland, Valor's breast oncology surgeon, and I'm proud to serve this community that I call home. When you come to Valor Oncology, you'll see the same dedicated team at every visit, physicians who know your history and are committed to your care. We offer state-of-the-art technology that rivals major cancer centers, combined with the personalized care you deserve. We are not just a team of doctors. We are part of the fabric of this community, and we are here for you today and tomorrow. When it comes to your health, you deserve expert care, compassion, and stability. Ask your doctor to refer you to Valor Oncology because we're committed to you and we're committed to Reading. Call 530-900-4000 or visit valor.org to schedule a consultation. Valor Oncology, rooted in Reading, focused on you.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenny, owner of Shasta Gas Propane and a Vietnam veteran. With Memorial Day coming up this 26th of May, I would like to remind you that it is more than a three-day weekend. With the words from President Ronald Reagan in one of his many Memorial Day speeches, he had just received the bodies of four Marines who had died while on active duty. He said, "There is a special sadness that accompanies the death of service members because our country is never quite good enough to them. Not really. We can't be, because what they gave us is beyond our power to repay. And all we can do is remember. Most of them were boys and girls when they died, and they gave up two lives, the one they were living and the one they would have lived. They gave up everything for us, and all we can do is remember and honor them. This Memorial Day, please remember and honor our fallen service men and women."
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network, podcast.hillsdale.edu. All of our shows, anywhere you find your audio. We've been talking with Dr. Colin Brown and his dissertation research into Benjamin Franklin, Revolutionary Statesman. Dr. Brown, how did Franklin's views, or did Franklin's views change as the crisis in the American political or in the American colonies developed?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you look at it just from a cursory glance, or it may seem like Franklin's views change. That's a big question within the scholarship as well. You know, you have this, a lot of historians, Gordon Wood, for instance, that characterize Franklin as an imperialist and a royalist during the 1750s and 1760s. And then suddenly at the earliest, 1769, if not a little bit later in the early 1770s, you know, Franklin becomes this American revolutionary and anti-monarchist and everything, and a Republican. So for historians, you know, the question is, how did he change? In my view, I don't think Franklin's views changed in principle. His principles remained the same. What changed was Franklin's estimation of what could be done practically. In the 1750s, he was more concerned with Pennsylvania politics, a little bit about colonial politics, and these are all wrapped up in the imperial politics of Britain. But Franklin believed that the best way to handle the crises before him was through reformation. Reform the governments under which you live rather than seek revolution. In the 60s, as the imperial crisis, the Stamp Act crisis and the like, as those come to the fore and start to worsen, Franklin at this time is still believing that there's ways of bringing the colonies and Great Britain together, right? We can come to compromises that would best achieve principled aims for the empire as a whole. But as those crises worsen and Franklin realizes that neither side is going to back down, and in particular the British, their views of the American colonists are worsening and they're choosing tyrannical means of dealing with the colonists, Franklin comes to see that revolution is the only legitimate and practical way of maintaining freedom in America.
Now, you mentioned earlier your research ends around 1760 or so. However, if we look forward just a little bit, are there big arcs or ideas we should know about how Franklin perhaps evolves or moves toward the Continental Congress and toward the revolution?
Yeah, certainly. I would actually say like you can see, and this is my dissertation, that you can see the revolutionary Franklin in the 1750s. That's what I would argue. But when the political crises between the colonies and Britain start to erupt in the early 1760s, one key event is going to be the Stamp Act crisis and how Franklin is navigating that. Towards the end of the 1760s, there are a number of laws that are being, or acts that are being passed by Parliament that Franklin is trying to either ameliorate or get repealed. During this period, he's navigating British parliamentary politics over in London and all their complexities. There is then the cockpit episode towards, this is on the eve of the revolution, where Franklin has to endure scathing criticism from the British government. He's there in person, and he's silent throughout the entire thing. And by that point, Franklin comes to the opinion that there, you know, the break is inevitable. The British won't see reason and certainly are not willing to act with justice. And so soon after the cockpit episode, he heads back to the colonies. By the time he gets into the colonies, Franklin is already kind of the most famous American, not only for his work on behalf of the various colonies. He was a colonial agent for not only Pennsylvania, but Massachusetts and a few others by this point. And he's a fairly old man. So by the time he gets back, he's kind of the sage of Philadelphia is a way of describing him. And he's certainly a natural person that the other revolutionaries would look to and want to get involved in the Continental Congress.
What's the Albany Plan and what was Franklin's role in that?
So the Albany Plan was one of the early, although not the earliest, one of the early plans to unite the different colonies in North America under one, at the very least, one military head. The colonies were very divided at this time. They each had their own governments. They were also very jealous of one another. And around 1754, you have the beginnings of the French and Indian War. The Albany Plan was initiated as a means of uniting the at least the military might of the colonies under one central head, thereby to be able to employ colonial military might on the frontier wherever it was needed. Franklin used the Albany Plan. He's considered the primary author of the initial drafts. There's some debate, but Franklin wrote up four different versions of his idea for the Albany Plan before the Albany Congress convened and drafted what would become the official Albany Plan. So Franklin's the primary author of it. He used the Albany Plan as a means, in my opinion, of trying to bring about some reforms to the British Empire. So not only did he want the colonies to be united for the sake of security and defense, but he also wanted to, he envisioned a through the Albany Plan, a means of achieving a more Republican or liberal structure and relationship between the colonies and the empire as a whole. The Albany Plan, unfortunately, was unsuccessful. It didn't, a lot of colonial legislatures thought it emphasized the powers of the crown a little too much for their liking. And then the British government and the imperial administrators thought that the plan was a little too democratic to their liking.
Dr. Colin Brown on Benjamin Franklin, Revolutionary Statesman. As we conclude here, how would you summarize your work? How would you summarize Franklin's legacy as a statesman?
Yeah, so I think Franklin's legacy is twofold. On the one hand, his writings and his life serve as kind of a model and an inspiration, not only for us today, but also he was an inspiration to the other founding fathers. He was one of the oldest. He was kind of the founder of the founding fathers in a sense. His writings from the 1750s get picked up in the 1760s and inspire a number of revolutionaries in political thought and their political thinking. James Madison, for instance, comments that some of these writings from the 1750s served or within them provide the germ or the seed of all that followed with the revolution. So on the one sense, I think Franklin captures and embodies what John Adams says. John Adams says that the real revolution did not happen in 1776. The real revolution happened in the hearts and minds of Americans 15 years beforehand, right, in the 1760s or so. I would say that Franklin was already priming his fellow Pennsylvanians and then the rest of Americans about 10 years before that. And so Franklin initiated, in some sense, that revolution in hearts and minds that would then take off in the 1770s, right, with the actual Revolutionary War. But also, his second legacy, I think, is Franklin helps to provide a model of how one might think about one's own regime and how to navigate it, right? If you're living in a regime that is not consistent with liberty, Franklin would provide a model of statesmanship that seeks to, not necessarily to jump to revolution right away. And so, to sum it up, I think, the second aspect of Franklin's legacy, and now I'm going to use a phrase from St. Thomas More, but it's, don't make the perfect the enemy of the good. Mm-hmm. And Franklin was very much concerned with achieving the good in the here and the now. He's also, he's kind of the founder of the American mind, but that would, be a much broader, larger discussion there.
Mm. Dr. Colin Brown, recently finishing his PhD at Hillsdale College's Graduate School of Statesmanship, now a postdoctoral associate at the Declaration of Independence Center for the Study of American Freedom at the University of Mississippi, his dissertation on Benjamin Franklin, Revolutionary Statesman. Dr. Brown, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Andrew Klavan, his new book, The Kingdom of Cain, and Dr. Colin Brown talking about Benjamin Franklin. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
To Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM. As of October 1st, 1942, according to Kentucky Law Code, anyone who handles a reptile in a religious service can be fined anywhere between $50 and $100. Even with this deterrent in place, snake handling during Pentecostal church services remains as a practice in Kentucky's countrysides. Rattlesnakes tend to be the snake of choice, and as one would imagine, the practice can be dangerous, with multiple deaths having been reported due to these services. Additionally, members of these churches often refuse medical treatment in the instance of a bite for religious reasons. Kentucky is not alone in having these snake-handling churches. The first recording of this practice was in Tennessee, and spread throughout Appalachia and beyond, even reaching Los Angeles, California. Snake-handling churches derive from multiple verses in the Bible, including a literal reading from a passage in the Gospel of Mark, which says, "They shall take up serpents, and if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them. They shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover." Coming out of the Pentecostal movement, which is a form of evangelical Protestantism, participants wish to feel a close connection to God. Members of these churches have claimed that those who have gotten bitten have handled the snake before it was spiritually ready. Services can also include speaking in tongues and other characteristics of Pentecostal churches. This particular law is rarely truly enforced, so much so that there have been several attempts at shows and documentaries following these churches. Reptiles and snakes are legal to own, and police have said in the past that they will not charge anyone unless a child becomes involved. So, next time you're in Kentucky, be wary of rattlesnakes, lest you have a spiritual experience and find yourself having to pay for it. This has been Megan Pidcock on Letter of the Law. If you want to hear more of Letter of the Law or other student shows like this, go to RadioFreeHillsdale.com. Once again, you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Hi, I'm Eric, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on natural rights versus entitlements.
America was founded on the idea that human beings are born with natural rights, such as the rights to life, liberty, and property. A person who holds this view of rights makes no demands on others except that they respect those rights. Today, however, many Americans talk about rights to a college education, state-of-the-art medical care, and even birth control pills. These are rights understood as entitlements, and a person who holds this view of rights, far from making no demands on other people, is making claims on other people's money and resources. This understanding of rights not only sets citizens against each other, but it undermines the whole idea of natural rights.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket Constitution and Declaration, go to ConstitutionMinute.com.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.